once again to KSLM Shalom Radio, Mark 1015 on your FM radio mode, where you can get a piece of the peace. We're coming to you live from the Holden Village Room here, somewhere back there. We're having technical difficulties, because you just please bear with me for Yeah, we're coming from Holden Village, where inclusive language is king. And women's lib is misguided. Get it? Misguided? Yeah. Tonight we begin our exodus of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Tonight's broadcast has been funded by merchants and dealers in and around the Holden area, including Gracie's Kitchen. No appetizers there at Gracie's, just the regular dinners. No need to appetize anyone. If you're not hungry, don't eat. That's what Gracie says. So keep a tight grip on your fork and don't fall from grace. Sorry. By Marsh's Wonder Garage. Marsh is gone this week, so we're running a sale on all items in stock. We won't be undersold or underestimated. This week's mechanic special includes transmission and complete engine overhauls. Our new mechanic will be experimenting with new and different rhythmic patterns in your valves and pistons. And by the remarkable, diverse, fun-loving perverts, the Holden Mavericks, where we do some of the necessary things and most of what's not. Sometimes, even more than once. And now, part 5 of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Good evening. As our story begins, we have... In our last episode, we have encountered the Heart of Gold as it has landed on the mythical planet of Magrathea. One of our heroes has been left stranded on the surface with the manically depressed robot Marvin, who is discovering that whale meat is not the best thing to stomp around in, and we have begun to follow the remaining cast of characters down into the chambers of the planet where luxury planets were manufactured in the days before the repressed economy, and as we left them, they were struggling to find out what was going on in Zaphod Beeblebrox's brain. We resume with chapter 21. On the surface of Magrathea, Arthur wandered about moodily. Ford had thoughtfully left him his copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, with which to while away the time. He pushed a few buttons at random.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a very unevenly edited book and contains many passages that simply seem to its editors to be a good idea at the time. One of these, the one Arthur now came across, supposedly relates the experiences of one Vit Vujagig, a quiet young student at the University of Maximegalon, who pursued a brilliant academic career studying ancient philology, transformational ethics, and the wave harmonic theory of historical perception. And then, after a night of drinking pangalactic gargle blasters with Zaphod Beeblebrox, became increasingly obsessed with the problem of what had happened to all the ballpoint pens he'd bought over the past few years. There followed a long period of painstaking research, during which he visited all the major centers of ballpoint loss throughout the galaxy, and eventually came up with a quaint little theory which quite caught the public imagination at the time. Somewhere in the cosmos, he said, along with all the planets inhabited by humanoids, reptiloids, fishoids, walking treoids, and superintelligent shades of the color blue, there was also a planet entirely given over to ballpoint life forms. And it was to this planet that unattended ballpoints would make their way, slipping away quietly through wormholes in space to a world where they knew they could enjoy a uniquely ballpointoid lifestyle, responding to highly ballpoint-oriented stimuli, and generally leading the ballpoint equivalent of the good life. And as theories go, this was all very fine and pleasant, until Vit Vujagig suddenly claimed to have found this planet, and to have worked there for a while driving a limousine for a family of cheap green retractables. Whereupon, he was taken away, locked up, wrote a book, and was finally sent into tax exile, which is the usual fate reserved for those who are determined to make fools of themselves in public. When one day an expedition was sent to the spatial coordinates that Vujagig had claimed for this planet, they discovered only a small asteroid inhabited by a solitary old man who claimed repeatedly that nothing was true, though he was later discovered to be lying. There did, however, remain the question of both the mysterious 60,000 Altarian dollars paid yearly into his Brantis Vogan bank account and, of course, Zaphod Beeblebrox's highly profitable second-hand ballpoint business.
Arthur read this and put the book down. The robot still sat there, completely inert. Arthur got up and walked to the top of the crater. He walked around the crater. He watched two suns set magnificently over Magrathea. He went back down into the crater. He woke the robot up, because even a maniacally depressed robot is better to talk to than nobody.
Night's falling. Look, robot, the stars are coming up.
I know. Wretched, isn't it?
But that sunset, I've never seen anything like it in my wildest dreams. Two suns? It was like mountains of fire boiling into space.
I've seen it. It's rubbish.
We only ever got one sun at home. It came from the planet called Earth, you know.
I know. You keep going on about it. It sounds awful.
Oh, no, it was a beautiful place.
Did it have oceans?
Oh, yes. Great, wide, rolling, blue oceans.
Can't bear oceans.
Tell me, do you get along well with other robots?
Hate them. Where are you going?
I think I'll take another walk.
Don't blame you.
Marvin counted 597 billion sheep before falling asleep again, a second later. Arthur slapped his arms about himself to try and get his circulation a little more enthusiastic about its job. He trudged back up the wall of the crater. Because the atmosphere was so thin, and because there was no moon, nightfall was very rapid, and it was by now very dark. Because of this, Arthur practically walked into the old man before he noticed him. He was standing with his back to Arthur, watching the very last glimmers of light sink into blackness beyond the horizon. He was tallish, elderly, and dressed in a single long gray robe. When he turned, his face was thin and distinguished, careworn but not unkind, the sort of face you would happily bank with. But he didn't turn yet, not even to react to Arthur's yelp of surprise. Eventually, the last rays of the sun vanished completely, and he turned. His face was still illuminated from somewhere, and when Arthur looked for the source of the light, he saw that a few yards away stood a small craft of some kind, a small hovercraft, Arthur guessed. It shed a dim pool of light around it. The man looked at Arthur, sadly, it seemed.
You choose a cold night to visit our dead planet.
Who are you?
The man looked away. Again, a look of sadness seemed to cross his face.
My name is not important.
He seemed to have something on his mind. Conversation was clearly something he felt he didn't have to rush at. Arthur felt awkward.
You startled me.
The man looked round again to him and slightly raised his eyebrows.
I said you startled me.
Do not be alarmed. I will not harm you.
But you shot at us. There were missiles.
The man gazed into the pit of the crater. The slight glow from Marvin's eyes cast very faint red shadows on the huge carcass of the whale. The man chuckled slightly.
An automatic system. Ancient computers ranged in the bowels of the planet tick away the dark millennia, and the ages hang heavy on their dusty databanks. I think they take the occasional pot shot to relieve the monotony. I'm a great fan of science, you know.
Oh, really?
Arthur was beginning to find the man's curious, kindly manner disconcerting.
Oh, yes.
He simply stopped talking again.
Arthur
had an odd feeling of being like a man in the act of adultery who is surprised when a woman's husband wanders into the room, changes his trousers, passes a few idle remarks about the weather, and leaves again.
You seem ill at ease.
No. Well, yeah. Actually, you see, we weren't really expecting to find anybody about, in fact. I sort of gathered that you were all, dead or something?
Dead? Good gracious me, no. We have but slept.
Slept?
Yes, through the economic recession, you see.
The The old man was apparently unconcerned about whether Arthur understood a word he was talking about or not. Arthur had to prompt him again.
Economic recession?
Well, you see, 5 million years ago, the galactic economy collapsed. And seeing that custom-built planets are something of a luxury commodity, you see.
He paused and looked at Arthur.
You know we built planets, do you?
Well, yes, I sort of gathered.
Fascinating trade. Doing the coastlines was always my favorite. Used to have endless fun doing the little bits and fjords. So anyway, the recession came and we decided it would save a lot of bother if we just slept through it. So we programmed the computers to revive us when it was all over.
The man stifled a very slight yawn and continued.
The computers were indexed linked to the galactic stock market prices, you see, so that we'd all be revived when everybody else had rebuilt the economy enough to afford our rather expensive services.
Arthur, who regularly read the Wall Street Journal, was deeply shocked at this.
That's a pretty unpleasant way to behave, isn't it?
Is it? I'm sorry. I'm a bit out of touch.
He pointed down into the crater.
Is that robot yours?
If you'd call it a robot, it's more a sort of electronic sulking machine.
Bring it.
Arthur was quite surprised to hear a note of decision suddenly present in the old man's voice. He called to Marvin, who crawled up the slope, making a big show of being lame, which he wasn't.
On second thoughts, leave it here. You must come with me. Great things are afoot.
He turned toward his craft, which, though no apparent signal had been given, now drifted quietly toward them through the dark. Arthur looked down at Marvin, who now made an equally big show of turning round laboriously and trudging off down into the crater again, muttering sour nothings to himself.
Come. Come now, or you will be late.
Late? For what?
What is your name, human?
Dent. Arthur Dent.
Late. Late as in the late Dent Arthur Dent. It's sort of a threat, you see.
Another wistful look came into his tired old eyes.
I've never been very good at them myself, but I'm told they can be very effective.
What an extraordinary person.
I beg your pardon.
Oh, nothing, I'm sorry. All right, where do we go?
In my air car.
The old man motioned Arthur to get into the craft, which had settled silently next to them.
We are going deep into the bowels of the planet, where even now our race is being revived from its 5 million year slumber. Magrathea awakes.
Arthur shivered involuntarily as he seated himself next to the old man. The strangeness of it, the silent, bobbing movement of the craft as it soared into the night sky, quite unsettled him. He looked at the old man, his face illuminated by the dull glow of tiny lights on the instrument panel.
Excuse me, what is your name, by the way?
My name? My name is Slartabartfast.
I beg your pardon?
Slartabartfast.
Slartabartfast?
The old man looked at him gravely.
I said it wasn't important.
The air car sailed through the night.
Announcing the grand opening of Holden Village's newest business, Honest Willie's Insurance Agency. Do you want to avoid being the butt of Gramps' so-called humor? Do you want once again to be able to relax as you go about your daily life in the village and not have to watch your every move for fear of supplying material for that loudmouth dummy? Loudmouth dummy? Now there's an oxymoron for you. Shut up. Your physical anomalies, be they corpse-like fingers, bowling ball craniums, macho muscles, or unmacho wisps of whiskers, will not be spotlighted for public ridicule. Neither will your job performance, or lack thereof. The next time Gramps performs, you won't need to squirm in fear of public humiliation. Sit back, relax, enjoy the fun, confident that your insurance policy has bought you protection. For the low, low price of one single scoop ice cream cone per week, you can purchase absolute immunity from having your name mentioned. Come to Honest Willie's Extortion Insurance Agency, suite number 7, amid the ambiance of Lodge 6, just kitty corner from the Holden Mall.
Thank you, Gramps. I'd like to say that I don't care too much about being insulted, but if you say anything about my mother, I'll break every knot in your body. Now, chapter 23 of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
It is an important and popular fact that things are not always what they seem. For instance, on the planet Earth, people had always assumed that they were more intelligent than dolphins because they had achieved so much. The wheel, New York, wars, and so on. Well, all the dolphins had ever done was muck about in the water having a good time. But conversely, the dolphins had always believed that they were far more intelligent than the humans, for precisely the same reasons. Curiously enough, the dolphins had known long before about the impending destruction of the planet Earth and had made many attempts to alert humans to the danger, but most of their communications were misinterpreted as amusing attempts to punch footballs or whistle for tidbits, so they eventually gave up and left the Earth by their own means shortly before the Vogons arrived. The last ever dolphin message was misinterpreted as a surprisingly sophisticated attempt to do a double backward somersault through a hoop while whistling the Star Spangled Banner, but in fact the message was this: so long and thanks for all the fish. In fact, there was only one species on the planet more intelligent than dolphins, and they spent a lot of their time in behavioral research laboratories, running around inside wheels and conducting frighteningly elegant and subtle experiments on humans. The fact that once again, human beings completely misinterpreted this relationship was entirely according to these creatures' plans. Chapter 24. Silently, the air car coasted through the cold darkness, a single soft glow of light that was utterly alone in the deep Magrathian night. It sped swiftly. Arthur's companion seemed sunk in his own thoughts, and when Arthur tried on a couple of occasions to engage him in conversation again, he would simply reply by asking if he was comfortable enough, and then left it at that. Arthur tried to gauge the speed at which they were traveling, but the blackness outside was absolute, and he was denied any reference points. The sense of motion was so soft and slight, he could almost believe they were hardly moving at all. Then a tiny glow of light appeared in the far distance, and within seconds had grown so much in size that Arthur realized it was traveling toward them at colossal speed, and he tried to make out what sort of craft it might be. He peered at it, but was unable to discern any clear shape, and suddenly gasped in alarm as the air car dipped sharply and headed downward in what seemed to be certain to be a collision course. The relative velocity seemed unbelievable, and Arthur had hardly time to draw breath before it was all over. The next thing he was aware of was an insane silver blur that seemed to surround him. He twisted his head sharply round and saw a small black point dwindling rapidly in the distance behind them, and it took him several seconds to realize what had happened. They had plunged into a tunnel in the ground. The colossal speed had been their own relative to the glow of light, which was a stationary hole in the ground, the mouth of the tunnel. The insane blur of silver was the circular wall of the tunnel down which they were shooting, apparently at several hundred miles an hour. He closed his eyes in terror. After a length of time, which he made no attempt to judge, he sensed a slight subsidence in their speed, and some while later became aware that they were gradually gliding to a gentle halt. He opened his eyes again. They were still in the silver tunnel, threading and weaving their way through what appeared to be a crisscrossed warren of converging tunnels. When they finally stopped, it was also in a small chamber of curved steel. Several tunnels also had their termini here, and at the farther end of the chamber, Arthur could see a large circle of dim, irritating light. It was irritating because it played tricks with the eyes. It was impossible to focus on it properly or tell how near or far it was. Arthur guessed, quite wrongly, that it might be ultraviolet. Slartabart Fast turned and regarded Arthur with his solemn old eyes.
Earthman, we are now deep in the heart of Magrathea.
How did you know I was an Earthman?
These things will come clear to you. At least, clearer than they are at the moment. I should warn you that the chamber we are about to pass into does not literally exist within our planet. It is a little too large. We are about to pass through a gateway into a vast tract of hyperspace. It may disturb you.
Arthur made nervous noises. Slartabartfast touched a button and added, not entirely reassuringly,
"It scares the willies out of me." Hold tight.
The car shot forward straight into the circle of light, and suddenly Arthur had a fairly clear idea of what infinity looked like. It wasn't infinity, in fact. Infinity itself looks flat and uninteresting. Looking up into the night sky is looking into infinity. Distance is incomprehensible, and therefore meaningless. The chamber into which the air car emerged was anything but infinite. It was just very, very, very big. So big that it gave the impression of infinity far better than infinity itself. Arthur's senses bobbed and spun as, traveling at the immense speed he knew the air car attained, they climbed slowly through the open air, leaving the gateway through which they had passed, an invisible pinprick in the shimmering wall beneath them. The wall. The wall defied the imagination, seduced it, and defeated it. The wall was so paralyzingly vast and sheer that at its top, bottom, and sides passed away beyond the reach of sight. The mere shock of vertigo could kill someone. The wall appeared perfectly flat. It would take the finest laser measuring equipment to detect that as it climbed, apparently to infinity, as it dropped dizzily away, as it planed out to either side, it also curved. It met itself again 13 light seconds away. In other words, the wall formed the inside of a hollow sphere, a sphere over 3 million miles across and flooded with unimaginable light.
Welcome.
The tiny speck that was the air car, traveling now at three times the speed of sound, crept imperceptibly forward into the mind-boggling space.
Welcome to our factory floor.
Arthur stared about him in a kind of wonderful horror. Ranged away before them, at distances he could neither judge nor even guess at, were a series of curious suspensions, delicate traceries of metal and light hung about shadowy spherical shapes that hung in the space.
This is where we make most of our planets, you see.
You mean you're starting it all up again now?
No, good heavens, no. No, the galaxy isn't nearly rich enough to support us yet. No, we've been awakened to perform just one extraordinary commission for very special clients from another dimension. It may interest you. There, in the distance, in front of us.
Arthur followed the old man's finger till he was able to pick out the floating structure he was pointing at. It was indeed the only one of the many structures that betrayed any sign of activity about it, though this was more a subliminal impression than anything one could put one's finger on. At that moment, however, a flash of light arced through the structure and revealed in stark relief the patterns that were formed on the dark sphere within. Patterns that Arthur knew, rough, blobby shapes that were as familiar to him as the shapes of words, part of the furniture of his mind. For a few seconds, he sat in stunned silence as the images rushed around his mind and tried to find somewhere to settle down and make sense. Part of his brain told him that he knew perfectly well what he was looking at and what the shapes represented, while quite another sensibly refused to countenance the idea and abdicated responsibility for any further thinking in this direction. The flash came again, and this time there could be no doubt.
The Earth.
Well, the Earth Mark II, in fact. We're making a copy from our original blueprints.
Are you trying to tell me that you originally made the Earth?
Oh, yes. Did you ever go to a place? I think it was called Norway.
No, I didn't.
Pity. That was one of mine. Won an award, you know. Lovely, crinkly edges. I was most upset to hear of its destruction.
You were upset?
Yes. 5 minutes later, and it wouldn't have mattered so much. It was a quite shocking cock-up.
Huh?
The mice were furious.
The mice were furious?
Oh, yes.
Yes, well, I expect the dogs and cats and duck-billed platypus, but...
But they hadn't paid for it, you see, had they?
Look, would it save you a lot of time if I just got up right now and went mad?
For a while, the air car flew on in awkward silence. Then the old man tried patiently to explain.
Earthman, the planet you lived on was commissioned, paid for, and run by mice. It was destroyed 5 minutes before the completion of the purpose for which it was built. And we've got to build another one.
Only one word was registering with Arthur.
I might?
Indeed, Earthman.
Look, sorry, are we talking about the little white furry things with the cheese fixation and the women standing on the table screaming in early 60s sitcoms?
Earthman, it is sometimes hard to follow your mode of speech. Remember, I have been asleep inside this planet of Magrathea for 5 million years, and know little of these early 60s sitcoms of which you speak. These creatures you call mice, you see, they are not quite as they appear. They are merely the protrusion into our dimension of vast, hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings. The whole business with the cheese and the squeaking is just a front.
The old man paused and continued after a sympathetic frown.
They've been experimenting on you, I'm afraid.
Arthur thought about this for a second, then his face cleared.
Oh, no. I see the source of the misunderstanding now. No, look. You see, what happened was that we used to experiment on them. They were often used in behavioral research, Pavlov and all that sort of stuff. So what happened was that the mice would be set in all sorts of tests, learning to ring bells, run around mazes, and do things so that the whole nature of the learning process could be examined. From our observations of their behavior, we were able to learn all sorts of things about our own.
Such subtlety. One has to admire it.
What?
How better to disguise their real natures, and how better to guide your thinking? Suddenly, running down a maze the wrong way, eating the wrong bit of cheese, unexpectedly dropping dead of myxomatosis. If it's finely calculated, the cumulative effect is enormous. You see, Earthman, they really are particularly clever, hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings. Your planet and people have formed the matrix of an organic computer running a 10-million-year research program. Let me tell you the whole story. It'll take a little time.
Time is not certainly one of my problems.
Now a word from our sponsor.
I never realized we had so much. Come and shop the Village Mall.
Sometimes known as the Creekside Mall.
Holden Faith and Trust, always open.
Holden Benboard, ask for a room with a view.
Holden Browsing By, the corner variety shop.
Holden Scoop and Lick and Drip. Count 'em, eight flavors.
Holden Stamp and Seal, friendliest postal service in the valley. Either snow or rain may delay mail. Closed Mondays for national holidays.
Holden Lint and Static, closed in the winter.
Holden Print and Fold, let us do the fall mailing.
Holden Pop, Salt, and Spill, delicious day-old popcorn.
Holden Shorts and Sweats, designer apparel.
Holden Chop and Munch, party supplies and dessert headquarters of the valley.
Holden Read and Write, the village stationers and booksellers.
Holden Pots and Shots, the village art gallery.
I never realized we had so much. Conveniently located across the street from Gracie's Restaurant and the Sports Arena. Directions from Lucerne, take the number 1 bus. You'll be dropped off at the front entrance. From Lyman Lake, take a left at Lodge 6.
We have restroom.
No hot water. Free parking.
Heat. Lights.
Most of the time.
Lockers.
Exercise spa and executive offices upstairs.
Displays change frequently.
Friendly service.
Get your mall charge card. Credit is easy to obtain.
All roads lead here.
Open some evening.
We are expanding our office suites. We are proud to announce the arrival of the national headquarters for the Holden Resource Center.
I never realized we had so much. Now back to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Chapter 25. There are, of course, many problems connected with life, of which some of the more popular are, why are people born? Why do they die? Why do they want to spend so much of the intervening time wearing digital watches? Many, many millions of years ago, a race of hyper-intelligent, pan-dimensional beings whose physical manifestation in their own pan-dimensional universe is not dissimilar to our own, got so fed up with the constant bickering about the meaning of life which used to interrupt their favorite pastime of Brockian Ultra Cricket, a curious game which involved suddenly hitting people for no readily apparent reason and then running away, that they decided to sit down and solve their problems once and for all. And to this end, they built themselves a stupendous supercomputer, which was so amazingly intelligent that even before its data banks had been connected up, it had started from I think, therefore, I am, and got as far as deducing the existence of rice pudding and income tax before anyone managed to turn it off. It was the size of a small city. Its main console was installed in a specially designed executive office, mounted on an enormous executive desk of finest ultra-mahogany, topped with rich ultra-red leather. The dark carpeting was discreetly sumptuous. Exotic potted plants and tastefully engraved prints of the principal computer programmers and their families were deployed liberally about the room, and stately windows looked out upon a tree-lined public square.